Today on Against the Grain, building solidarity across racial lines has been one of the thorniest problems of the left in the United States, stymieing struggles against capitalism over generations. I'm Sasha Lilly. I'll speak with David Roediger about race, class, and solidarity, as well as about the radical scholar George Rawick and the organization Facing Reality. From the studios of KPFA in Berkeley, California, this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm Sasha Lilly. How should radicals understand the interaction of class and race in the United States, where capitalism seems especially effective in pitting people against each other based on racial divisions? In his latest book of essays, Class, Race, and Marxism, published by Verso, David Roediger grapples with that broad question from multiple angles. Roediger is professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University and one of the founders of Critical Whiteness Studies. His many books include The Wages of Whiteness, and he joins me again today. David, in your book Seizing Freedom, which I spoke with you about last year, you write about the moment following the Civil War and the self-emancipation of the slaves where solidarity was extended to and between various oppressed groups. Solidarity is one of the pillars of the left, the idea that an injury to one is an injury to all, and that we need to fight for each other's freedom. But you suggest that solidarity is easy to evoke, but often quite fragile.
Yes, the last essay in this book is kind of an attempt to make a problem out of solidarity and to kind of hope that we can be a little bit more forgiving of each other around our failures in terms of solidarity. And it really grew out of kind of the Black Lives Matter movement and other movements in the Midwest here that were spectacularly great, but also at certain points fell apart. And I wanted to try to understand the ways in which, because people are oppressed in different ways and to different degrees, they're efforts to be in alliances with each other are bound sometimes to be vexed. So in that Seizing Freedom example, there was a splendid series of acts of solidarity between feminists and abolitionists, for example. But then when it came time for the 14th and 15th Amendments, and feminists had to decide whether they would sign on to those amendments without women getting rights, particularly the right to vote, then it became clear that the formerly enslaved people white women were not in an easy alliance, and very, very tough decisions had to be made. And I didn't come down in the essay here or in the Seizing Freedom book about what people should have decided. I was kind of settling for pointing out what a difficult situation even really great people with great friendships and a 30-year track record like Frederick Douglass and Susan B. Anthony couldn't really actually remain in alliance under those kinds of pressures. So I wanted to think about solidarity as something that doesn't automatically happen and that sometimes is going to fail, so that we both think of it as more precious and but also a little bit more rare.
As a historian of labor and of race, do you think that radical scholars should be cautious in the ways they record instances of solidarity? I mean, clearly, the writing of history and of moments where people did extraordinary things both serves a purpose in terms of documenting what often otherwise could be a lost history, and also can be very inspiring in the present, or something that we in contemporary struggles might draw from. But are there any perils in that?
Well, I think we have to be able to do both. I think we have to be able to celebrate instances of solidarity in history, but at the same time to not romanticize them so much in the past that we always fall short in the present, and we always beat ourselves up about falling short in the present. When I first gave that, what became the essay on solidarity as a talk, I played my old friend Utah Phillips singing Solidarity Forever as part of the talk. And by that time in the talk, I had thought that I had sort of problematized the notion of solidarity, and half the audience sang along with Utah when he sang. And I, you know, I was glad, and I thought if I were in the audience, that would have been me as well. But I'm also wanting to make a separate point about the difficulties of solidarity.
Do you think that there are lessons for activists in thinking around this? I mean, I think a lot of activists are probably very aware of the difficulties in making alliances and getting people to struggle for causes that may not seem to be their own immediate causes.
Yes, one of the lessons I think is this lesson around the preciousness of solidarity. And I think that sometimes we should be reminded to stick with these difficult moments a little bit longer than might even seem rational, and to try to hope that things change or that we make it through in some way while we recognize the depth of differences. I mean, again, I think about the Frederick Douglass, Susan B. Anthony one. Anthony, from her point of view, I think was exactly right to say, I have to be in a different organization now from Frederick Douglass. He's no longer fighting in this moment for women's suffrage. Douglass was right from his point of view to say, we have to get something. This is the moment to get suffrage for Black men. Maybe it'll protect us against Klan violence and have some kind of influence over Reconstruction policies. At the end of the day, though, I wonder if Douglass might have stayed in alliance with the feminists, even if it meant getting less. And in other words, prioritizing the solidarity over the immediate result. It's a very hard thing to ask of activists in a moment. And, you know, Douglass didn't know that voting rights were only going to be good for another 15 years and then not for another 70 years. And so, you know, it's just a difficult set of circumstances. And I think we need to be, you know, grown up enough to live with the difficulties.
Your book, as the title indicates, Class, Race, and Marxism, looks probingly, the essays in the book, at race and class. And the questions of race and class, the conundrums of race and class, have all sort of exploded with the neoliberal politics of Hillary Clinton and her defeat by Donald Trump reignited a debate on the left about identity politics versus class politics. And of course, as a debate, it's not new. And I wonder if you could talk about the history of these debates within the left.
Yeah. I wrote during the first Clinton presidency and the run-up to the first the Bill Clinton presidencies about how the right turn of the Democratic Party at that time was kind of premised on the idea that they weren't going to give anything meaningful to the labor movement. And so if they were going to make an appeal to white workers, it had to be an appeal based on, as they put it, listening to white workers and listening to them in their homes and not in their unions, not in their workplaces, listening to them in segregated communities. And then what they were going to hear was that white working people were concerned about busing, were concerned about crime, were concerned about taxes, were concerned about all of the code words that the Republicans had been so good at exploiting. And so you end up with this situation in which electoral politics don't really allow aggressive demands on either race or class fronts. And then I think that debate ended with many of us thinking, well, it must be impossible to agitate for racial justice and class justice at the same time, or at least very difficult. So, for example, in the past campaign, when Ta-Nehisi Coates encouraged Bernie Sanders to think about reparations as a demand, that article by Coates was kind of hooted at, and particularly hooted at by people on the left, who sort of said, no, all you can do is this kind of class social democratic free college for all sort of healthcare demands, which are important demands, but which again buy into that same idea that you can't agitate aggressively along racial lines and class lines at the same time. So this is the debate goes back before the first Clinton one. You could take it back to the early 20th century when Eugene Debs said the Socialist Party has nothing special to offer the Negro, that it's about class and not race to be a radical in the United States, and then was very much answered and himself moved in different and better directions as Black activists challenged Debs. So it's a very, very old debate, but I think we're in a very bad moment of it because we end up in this situation in which we really firmly believe that it's hard to think about race and class at the same time. And I'm not sure it should be. I think it ought to be possible to have both of those sets of demands on the table. And if one is particularly aggressive, I think it would encourage us to be aggressive about the other set of demands as well.
Well, it seems to muddy the waters that, at least around what gets called identity politics, that there are neoliberal variants that are not part of the left. And so people on the left will say, well, we don't want anything to do with that. But for a radical critique of capitalism, how do you think we should understand the relationship between race and class? That is a perspective that's situated very firmly on the radical left.
Well, I want to take up the first point for a minute, and then you can maybe remind me of the second. But I think you're exactly right that we're vexed by the fact that we have so much liberal multiculturalism in this society, which really, again, doesn't practice affirmative action aggressively, doesn't discuss reparations at all, kind of sidelines any substantive structural change where race is concerned, but produces a lot of race talk and a lot of the feeling that the corporation is behind multiculturalism. And that elbows out and I think discredits a kind of a left multiracialism that we really kind of urgently need. And that left multiracialism, to maybe go to the second part of your question, that left multiracialism would realize that race struggles are class struggles also. So that one of the things I argue strongly for in the introduction to this book is that the movement around Mike Brown's murder and in Ferguson, and then what became a movement against traffic stops and racial profiling by the police, that's a race movement, but it was also a movement very much in the interest of working class people, mostly in this case, Black working class people. So I think it's important not to draw some kind of a firm line between race and class, a line that's so firm that we end up not realizing that Black people are overwhelmingly working class people, that Latinos are overwhelmingly working class people. And so these demands are bound to penetrate into each other. These movements are bound to be about race and class at the same time. Now, you know, the attack on that tends to say, no, the racial justice struggles are sanctioned by capital, sanctioned by elites, in order to draw our attention away from economic grievances. I think that both the race and class struggles are real, and we have to start from that point of view, that whether liberal multiculturalist corporatists were forwarding this race talk or not, there'd still be serious things for us to address in trying to build a unified working class movement that has to take race seriously.
I'm speaking with David Roediger, professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University. My name is Sasha Lilly, and this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. So, David, then, given what you've said, that there is not a hard and fast line between race and class, often, and you read about this in your book, Class, Race, and Marxism, when race and class are discussed, often there's the evocation of the logic of capital. You know, following the logic of capital, would a racial struggle or a labor struggle be sanctioned or not sanctioned? And it leads to the question of how should we, and this is my question for you, how should we understand capitalism as it relates to race and class?
Well, I'm very attracted by the work of the Canadian Marxist economist, Michael Lebowitz, who argues that we need to think about capital as a system that requires dividing workers. It requires dividing workers at the polls. It requires dividing workers in factories. It requires dividing workers by borders. So if that's the case, that one of the, he says, variables that ought to be thought of when we think the logic of capital is the necessity to divide workers, then it becomes easier to talk about how race figures into capitalist logic, because sometimes we tend to think, and the Communist Manifesto maybe tended to think, that capital would just as soon have everybody the same that's working in a factory, making the same motions, thinking the same thoughts, being unified in those ways, losing nationality, Marx and Engels thought at that time in their life, losing particularities, losing racial distinctions. But it turns out, and by the time of the Civil War, I think Marx saw this fairly clearly, that it's really the division that also is necessary if a system is going to work. Managers don't want a completely unified workforce in a factory, for example. So I think that this insight of Lebowitz that there's a part of the logic of capital that is about the necessity to create division. And he's a serious economist. He wants to actually name that variable and change equations in the first volume of Capital. I think that's a really important insight, whether we go into the math or not, to just be able to see it that way as a metaphor is useful for us, I think.
And although we're mainly focusing in this hour on race and class, certainly an argument about the production of difference and conflict could also apply to gender, could it not?
Yes, in the phrase, the production of difference, that's the title of a book that I wrote with Elizabeth Esch about 5 or 6 years ago, actually comes from Lisa Lowe's work, and Lisa's theorizes it as much, I think, around gender as she does around race and nationality. One of the essays in Class, Race, and Marxism tries to think about this, the way that gender would help us to rethink race and class in the 1830s, 40s, and 50s, for example.
Well, one of the things that comes up when talking about understanding capitalism and the production of difference and the divisions between people is, as we've noted earlier, that often there is an assumption that a lot of these ideas aren't coming out of the left. And you note in Class, Race, and Marxism that actually what has come to be called as whiteness studies actually comes out of Marxism. I wonder if you could tell listeners who may not be familiar with that term, whiteness studies, what that means and its relationship to the Marxist tradition.
Thank you. I guess at the time of the Reagan presidency, a whole bunch of books got written, mostly academic books, some not academic books, that sort of had whiteness in their title, or at least made whiteness a problem. And I think we can see why that might be the case during the Reagan and then first Bush presidency. In terms of the ways that the so-called Reagan Democrat, the Reagan voting, formerly New Deal voting Democrat, was motivated by race. And so a lot of us thought, well, where does this white worker come from? What's its history? Why is it that when we say white worker, so often the accent falls on white, and so seldom does it fall on worker? So Ted Allen wrote such a book. I wrote Wages of Whiteness at that time. Noel Ignatieff, Michael Rogan, Toni Morrison, her Playing in the Dark is very much about whiteness. It comes from that time. The great legal California historian Cheryl Harris, his Whiteness as Property, dates from just this moment where people are thinking about the Reagan presidency and thinking about all of the kind of political possibilities that are shut off by the commitment of so many United States people to defining their identity as white. So it's at that moment that this field of study becomes a trend within academia. I think it's a little bit regrettable. I still always call it critical whiteness studies. Otherwise, it sounds like maybe you want to have a white studies department in the university. So I'm not advocating for anything like that. It really, what gets underlined usefully, though, by dating it from that period is to say all the more that critical study of whiteness is making whiteness into a problem. And so here, this political problem of Reagan and this seemingly lasting Republican hegemony partly around race and whiteness attracted a lot of scholarly and popular attention as people tried to figure it out. In particular, people who were influenced by Marxism, people who were on the left, and of course, people of color were people who knew that whiteness was a problem for them. If they were trying to survive, if they were trying to get ahead in the world, in the case of the left, if they were trying to build a unified social movement, they had to confront whiteness as a problem. And so if we went further back than the Reagan presidency, we'd go to W.E.B. Du Bois, we'd go to James Baldwin, we'd go to Ida B. Wells, we'd go maybe to the slave folk tales about the master, we'd go to Native indigenous folk tales about contact with whites. All of this study in the broadest sense of whiteness as a problem. And that, in the academic sense, has been overwhelmingly forwarded by people who come out of the Marxist tradition.
Looking back at this history, what do you think are the limitations of whiteness studies?
Now, that's a good question. I never have been able to think about whiteness studies as something that sits by itself. I think that once we say that it comes out of Baldwin and it comes out of Du Bois and it comes out of Paredes and the Latino tradition, once we say that, I think we need to say it's part of ethnic studies. And one of the things that vexes me about critical whiteness studies inside the universities is that very often I think it doesn't realize that about itself. It sort of believes that it could be housed in any department and could, and it often devolves into a kind of sensitivity training, which is for white students, which is not unuseful, but also is not as rigorous sometimes as it could possibly be, not as curious, doesn't get too much beyond shibboleths about how people on the surface need to change in order to be an ally or to be a non-racist person. So I worry about that kind of almost therapeutic tendency and the way that almost therapeutic tendency actually is very easily taken over by corporate multiculturalism and by the diversity industry and people who come into universities and train people around anti-racism. That discourse of, how do you become a good white person in 45 minutes almost certainly disallows any kind of attention to the structures that keep inequality in place and make the whole issue one of personal choices and the kinds of words people use.
I'd like to turn to George Rawick, who is a mentor of yours and whom you write about in the essay, a white intellectual among thinking Black intellectuals. He was the editor of a 41-volume set of oral histories of former slaves. That's the American Slave composite autobiography. He's not a known figure for most people on the left now. Can you tell us about his contributions to radical thinking and out of what world he came?
Sure. He came very much out of the Jewish left in Brooklyn. For a time, he was a communist. He very quickly became a part of the anti-Stalinist left in his youth. And joined, I think, just about every possible group that you could join, probably a score of groups in his life, and he'd run through them. And then he ended up being a follower and co-thinker of the great Trinidadian, British, and United States Marxist C.L.R. James. So he's part of this group called Facing Reality in Detroit, and with James, with Marty Glaberman, with, for a time, Raya Danayevskaya, and these important figures on the intellectual and activist U.S. left. And he very much began to believe that you learn by listening to oppressed people more than you learn by developing a program for oppressed people to subscribe to. So he kind of describes in the late 50s being at meetings in the civil rights movement, and people would come up to him, African-American people would come up to him and say, okay, what's the program that you're pushing? And he realized that he didn't have a program and that he wanted to hear what they had to say and what they where they thought the movement might go. And so this fit in very much with James's approach and Facing Reality's approach, that much of their newspaper would just be letters from workers and to try to figure out what workers were thinking. And it also fits in then with these 41 volumes that you're talking about. He became interested in what we could know about slavery from the slave's point of view. And he found these 41 volumes of 1930s interviews with ex-slaves. And he very much became, for most of his academic life then, a listener to those voices of ex-slaves. So I think he kind of becomes the very opposite of a vanguardist left. He comes out of a vanguardist left, but isn't at all interested by his 40s or so in being a vanguard, but rather kind of the reverse in being somebody who tries to figure out what might be bubbling up from the voices below.
That's the voice of David Roediger. We'll return with him in just a moment. You're listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is Sasha Lilly, and today I'm joined by David Roediger. He's professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University. His many books include Our Own Time and the Wages of Whiteness, and he is the author, which we're discussing today, of the book Class, Race, and Marxism. It's published by Verso, and you can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And in that book, he explores a number of themes in a series of essays. And one of them, which we've just been discussing, pertains to the figure of George Rawick. And you mentioned the group Facing Reality that Rawick was part of. and the figure C.L.R. James. And I wonder if you could talk more about that group. It was very small, and yet it has had an outsized influence on how people come at a whole series of questions. But I wonder if you could talk about that group and the work of its members and of C.L.R. James especially.
I'm so excited to think about this today. 2 days ago, I found out that Class, Race, and Marxism won the C.L.R. James Prize from the Working Class Studies Association.
It's a small
association, but the best name for a prize that I could win out of anything. I met James late in his life, in part through Rawick, when C.L.R. was living in Brixton. I got to visit with him and tried to interview him, ended up getting kind of schooled by him instead. He talked about Hegel. I wanted to talk about Southeast Missouri and sharecropper strikes, and he wanted me to learn about Hegel. And so he won that tug of war. But for me, the Jamesite tradition was very liberating in the same way that it was liberating for Rawick, and that is that it posited a much more formless left, a left that had to be agile and attentive to how people were thinking about their own situations. And, you know, sometimes that meant that organizationally it was weak. As you pointed out how small it was, it never had more than a few hundred people, mostly in Detroit, but in other cities. And then C.L.R. goes back to Britain. But it was a group that during the rebellions in Detroit and then during the period of the League of Revolutionary Black Workers, it provided a lot of knowledge of Marxism, knowledge of left history to actors on the ground, but it didn't recruit them. And some in the group, James, really wanted to try to have a large organization that could recruit workers, but that existed very much in tension with the idea of being a group of listeners, because it wasn't too clear what you were recruiting people to in that situation. So the group actually disbanded at the height of its influence after the Detroit rebellions and the Wildcat strikes in Detroit. But partly out of this tension, it, I think, is very much a part of our moment where we're trying to figure out how to have a left that is broad and not claiming a scientific truth, but rather claiming an ability to hear and maybe help articulate what working people are saying.
Tell us a little more about the context in which Facing Reality did have an impact. You mentioned the ferment in Detroit, and although I think a generation of radicals knows all about that, younger generations don't. So can you tell us what was happening in Detroit? What made that such a exciting time for radicals?
Well, this was the period of Black Power, and so it was the period of Black Power in the streets and the anti-police brutality rebellions that were giant in Detroit in the late 60s, but also a period of Black Power in the plants. And this was the League of Revolutionary Black Workers. And many of those young people who were in the League were people who had gone to study groups, learned, read Capital, thought about practical questions of organizing under the auspices of Facing Reality. Facing Reality had a lot of emphasis on being in the plants.
And by plants, you mean the plants of the auto industry.
Yeah, in the auto plant. So people like Marty Glaberman, who, you know, maybe if people know him, they know him as a sociologist and a historian and a poet. The late Marty Glaberman was somebody who was an auto worker for many, many years. He was a person who was radicalized, had education, and then went into the plants. James Oggs, who was for a time associated with Facing Reality, with Correspondence, the predecessor to Facing Reality. James Boggs was another person who tried to think about the experience in the plant what he was hearing in the plant, and then to think about what would that mean for how we live in a city and how we think about what's possible and what we might make out of Detroit. And the rebellion in 67 very much underlined that as a question, because the plants kept going during the rebellion, and people had to think about, you know, what did that mean, that there was this kind of urban insurrection, but not necessarily a disruption in production. And so this was a group that was very, very attentive to the relationship between political economy and daily life, and didn't, I think, come up with any compelling solution to thinking about, you know, where does industry end and where does the community begin and where do you organize? They were almost all believed that organizing in industry was vitally important, and it was in factories that people learned the kinds of values and mutuality that could produce a radical movement. But they were also living in the period of Black Power and seeing the ways that this spilled out in all sorts of different directions that went beyond industry. So it was a period in which people could have a lot of ideas, but also that realities changed so fast that it was kind of difficult, I think, to build a presence that people knew what the group stood for. It was kind of a group that was constantly trying to find out what it stood for.
In your essay on George Rawick, and including on Facing Reality, you mentioned the term he used, of working class self-activity. For mm-hmm. people who haven't heard the phrase before, it sounds possibly redundant. What does self-activity mean? But what does the phrase mean, and why was it significant for Rawick and for his larger milieu?
Well, I think the phrase kind of grows out of very early internationalist Marxist, the First International's phrases about the emancipation of the working class is the task of the working class itself. So that it goes back to that, I think, 1862 phrase, which uses emancipation because emancipation is so in the air as a result of the self-activity of United States slaves. So there's this becomes this kind of emancipationist impulse inside of Marxism, which says it's not the intellectuals who are going to do this. It's not the party that's going to do this. It's something that happens actually in working class life, that people form these relationships which enable them to struggle. Now, being in auto factories was one, or being around people who were in auto factories was one way that Rawick was allowed to see this. He was, you know, he could know that the union had a presence in the factories, but so too did all of these small work groups that supported each other, that covered each other when somebody was too tired to stand up on the assembly line, that would move in and take each other's jobs for short periods, that would shut down the line if there was a danger, even if the union was mandated by the contract to say, no, you have to keep producing. So it was these kinds of, one might say, autonomous actions that workers organized on their own, and that, you know, some of these actions supported people who were then working class leaders in the communities and wrote and came to study groups and thought, but some didn't. Some were just people who defended each other on the job and were friends and had barbecues together and developed these kinds of organic ties that made workers' power in factories possible. And so George was always very interested in that. When he wrote about the rise of the CIO, the Congress of Industrial Organizations, the great industrial unions of the 1930s, he said, we always have to realize that the unions didn't organize the workers into the CIO. the workers organized and then there could be a CIO. So he was interested in the period between 1933 and 1936 or so, when it was kind of, I don't want to say spontaneous. He didn't believe they were spontaneous. You know, there were leaders, but there were so many leaders and there was so little structure that it makes sense to call that self-activity.
How did he and his comrades understand autonomous moments of self-activity that were directed against other workers? For example, trying to shut out other workers because of their race or gender.
Yeah. Well, Marty Gleiberman, who was part of this group, wrote a book called Wildcat Strikes describing strikes that happened during World War II. And, you know, quite a few of those strikes were hate strikes. And I think it's a strain. I mean, there's no part of Gleiberman or any of these people that are being described that supported hate strikes or that thought, as long as anything workers do is fine. But I think within that book, it was a hard thing for Gleiberman to get at. And when I say Gleiberman, all the Facing Reality things were written as a result of consultations. And it's very, very hard to say who wrote what in that group because everybody met so often with each other and hashed things out. And there are whole articles that we don't really know who wrote, and it doesn't really make sense to say one person wrote. But this book that Gleiberman produced, I think the weakest part of it, its cover has a very joyous black worker presumably participating in a wildcat walkout. But then as you read it, you realize that some of those wildcat walkouts would have been directed against that black worker. And it becomes a very difficult thing, I think, that goes back to this question of race and class. Because some of our tradition of what gets called working class, I would say it's white self-activity, but what gets called working class self-activity was anti-Chinese. Much of it was, now is to enforce the border and to unions reporting on undocumented people at their workplaces. So all of these things that we want to valorize the impulse toward taking action on one's own, but those actions also sometimes reflect the hideousness of the whole society.
That's David Roediger. He is the author of Class, Race, and Marxism, published by Verso. And I'm Sasha Lilly. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Well, one member of this group Facing Reality was Selma James, and her work was premised very deeply on understanding difference within the working class. Can you tell us about her work and how the work of George Rawick and others related to her work, some of which I think was expanded in her time outside of Facing Reality, after Facing Reality?
Right. Selma and George Rawick actually were at the same high school in Brooklyn. They were at Erasmus High School, Their meeting in the radical left that becomes Facing Reality was actually a re-meeting of people who were together as teenagers. And out of all of the, there were very forceful women constantly in correspondence and Facing Reality. Raya Dunayevskaya is another. That tendency then was called the Johnson Forrest tendency, and Johnson was the pseudonym of C.L.R. James and Forrest was the pseudonym of Dunayevskaya. And then in the Facing Reality group, Selma James is this towering figure and very much contributes in many, many ways theoretically. But the one that she's probably stuck with, the two that she's probably stuck with for her whole life are around the question of the reproduction of the working class, social reproduction, and what sometimes gets rendered in shorthand as wages for housework. And the extent to which she and Italian feminists and others argued that the question of wages for housework could open up a whole set of debates about women's labor in the household, as well as women's wage labor. Very important contributions in that. And then when I saw her in London 2 years ago, her work is also very much about organizing sex workers and thinking about the safety and solidarity that can be practiced by sex workers.
In the minutes that we do have remaining of the program, I want to return to the present and talk about the conundrums for the left as well as radical scholars about thinking about this moment and struggling in this moment. And I wanted to ask you about the title of one of your essays, which is Retreat from Race and Class. There were some since, I think, the Reagan years who argued that there was a retreat from class on the left. You seem to be suggesting that that retreat has been a double one. Can you tell us what you mean by it and tell us about the consequences politically?
Yeah, I don't want to lean on electoral presidential politics too much as a shorthand for more complicated things, but I do want to go back to the point I made earlier about this moment in the Clinton turn to the right of the Democratic Party, in which he gets rid of affirmative. He polls workers and then reports that workers, white workers, want to tackle these social issues, supposedly don't in the polling say, my problem is with wages, my problem is with working conditions, my problem is that the unions are being decimated. They instead talk about busing and crime and maybe at a later period, gay marriage and these culture war issues and race issues. So that was a moment, I think, where Clinton decides to decimate affirmative action, decides to sign on to the ending of welfare as we know it, decides to sign the and forward the Effective Death Penalty Act, expand three strikes and you're out, all of these things that came back to haunt Hillary Clinton in the electoral campaign, kept a lot of people away from the polls in her campaign, were things that were done in the name of paying attention to the white working class. So that, you know, this was like, oh, we have to take seriously the grievances of white workers. My point would be that if we're talking about a working class, those grievances are class grievances. They're not busing. They're not these code words for race. They're actually, if you want to listen to the white working class, the solution is to forward class demands, not to forward these retrograde race demands. And I think we keep getting hung up on that problem. And I think we're very much in another moment where in the next round of elections, and elections seem to be going on almost all the time now, in the next round of elections, there'll be a lot of talk about listening to the white working class. Joan Williams's book called White Working Class is very much a plea that what the Democrats have to do, and therefore, you know, much of the left that supports the Democratic Party would end up doing, is to go back to hear these grievances of white working class people. And I just think that that's almost certain to end in hearing their grievances as white and not hearing their grievances as working class people.
Well, looking further into the future, much has been made of demographic change in the U.S., that the population of the U.S. is getting younger, that it's getting darker, that it's getting more progressive. So given that the working class historically has seemed as if when people have said the working class, the image that is conjured up in people's minds is the white working class, not the broad, multiracial, multi-ethnic working class. But with time, presumably, that will shift or potentially could shift. Do you think that the changing racial composition of the working class will help with these seemingly intransigent problems of race and class, or do you think that's hoping demographics will solve everything? And what about also the issues of racial divisions amongst non-white workers?
Yeah, I, to take that last point, I think that the most important form of solidarity in our period is Black-Latino solidarity. And if you take those demographic shifts seriously, I think it's clear that that's a solidarity that can be productive of a lot of change if it's a solidarity that's real and deep. I'm a little cautious about saying, you know, a lot of these articles say by 2050, the United States will no longer be a white nation. People kind of said that in 1895 about what was going to happen as Eastern and Southern Europeans came into the country. And then they were in a harrowing process, but eventually became part of the white majority in the United States. So I don't know that, I think it's a political question whether or not lots of, say, Latino people in the third generation will think of themselves as part of a coalition of people who are oppressed racially, or they won't think of themselves in that way. You could think about Cubans in the current moment and the ways that they're pulled along race and class and sure. global politics lines. So I think all of these are political questions about how people are going to identify. And I have great hope for young people, but you know, I came into the New Left at a time when everybody was saying, oh, you think I'm radical? Just wait until you meet my younger brother and sister. And it turned out that those younger brothers and sisters weren't necessarily more radical than we were. So, you know, I think all of these things are things that we can be hopeful about, but we also have to try to influence where the processes go.
David Roediger, thank you so much for coming back on the program.
Thank you. I really love being interviewed by you.
Well, it's my pleasure. David Roediger is professor of American Studies and History at Kansas University and the author of Class, Race, and Marxism, published by Verso. You can find a link to it on our website, againstthegrain.org. And you've been listening to Against the Grain. I'm Sasha Lilly. Thanks so much for listening, and please tune in again next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. Please visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio and a way to sign up for our podcast. And you can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio or follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.